afternoon. The Jensen is really delighted to see you here this afternoon, especially whether it's snowing or raining or sunny. But thank you for spending some time with us. I know it's a really busy time this semester. But we are really delighted to have the author, Sabrina Vana, visiting us here at MSU. She spent the day, we worked her hard. She's met with undergrads and grad students and a couple faculty. And she's really looking forward to sharing with you about her work interviewing the 16 Nobel Peace Laureates. And we know that, but yet it was like hearing it again. Yes, there were in all the whole life of the Nobel Peace Laureates, there's only 16 of them. But we get to learn about them today. So please welcome
Ms.
Vana.
Thank you. Hello, thank you. Thank you for having me here. I'm an author of a book, Battling Injustice, 16 Nobel Laureates, and as you're having the book, this is the book. And the foreword is by the Indian Nobel Peace Prize winner, Kailash Satyarthi. He got the prize with Malala Yousafzai in 2014, and these are the laureates, right from Malala Yousafzai, Ellen Johnson. I mean, I can just briefly tell, before starting the lecture about, who's who in this. The first is Malala Yousafzai. She got the prize in 2014, and she was from Pakistan. She was, shot by Taliban in the head, so the world knows about her story, champion of girl education. The second one here is the Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. She was the former president of Liberia, and a great woman. She got the prize in 2011. The third one is Lema Beboi. She is from Africa and Liberia again. And she is a champion of, human rights there in Liberia. The third is Tawakkul Karman. She is from Yemen, right now living in Istanbul. And she is also known as the mother of Arab Spring. So she is the first Arab woman to get Nobel Peace Prize. Then we have Wangari Maathai from Kenya. She is no more, but her work, she was the founder of Green Belt Revolution. So Wangari Maathai. Then we have Shireen Ebadi. Shireen Ebadi is from Iran. And she was the first Muslim woman to get Nobel Peace Prize, and she's from Iran. Then we have an American Nobel Peace Prize winner, and actually currently the only woman American Nobel Peace Prize winner is actually Jody Williams, and she worked for Tibet and the landmines. Then we have Rigoberta. She is extremely popular all over the world, and she's from Guatemala, and she's a champion of the indigenous people. And then we have Aung San Suu Kyi from Myanmar, and she was a champion of democracy, and she's a person to actually end the rule of military junta because of her work. Then we have Alva Myrdal from Sweden, again a great person, working for the human rights. And of course, then we have Mother Teresa, the world knows about it. I don't have to introduce about her. And we have Betty Williams then. She's from Ireland. So Betty Williams and Mairead McGuire, the next lady, both of them from Ireland. So they are from Ireland. And then another is the American Nobel Peace Prize winner, Jane Addams, who, the first American woman to get Nobel Peace Prize is actually Jane Addams. Then we have Emily Green Balch. And the last one is Pratha Wansapner, who was the first woman to get Nobel Peace Prize. And now recently, Nadia Murad got the Nobel Prize, and she'll be getting the Nobel Prize on 10th of December. So this will be 17 now. So in the history of 107 years and more than that, only 16 women have got Nobel Prize. And Nadia Murad just recently got, and she's from Iran. And she's she's from Iraq. And basically a Yazidi. So Yazidi is a kind of a different kind of religion, and she's from there. So, it is indeed a matter of deep concern that although the mankind has evolved in this journey of about 5,000 years and almost reached zenith of its endeavor in the field of medical and scientific research, engineering and technological architectural advancement, explored and discovered myriad mysteries of nature, both of earth and space, and has also produced such nuclear weapons which may devastate the entire world in a few moments, Now almost everything of comfort and luxury, you know, comes by just the recitation of the magical words abracadabra, yet could not search towards world peace. With justice and equity, and it still has solid its course with wars, orchestrated exploitation, and persecution of the weak and the poor, and found glory in the suppression of fellow human beings on the grounds of race, ethnicity, caste, color, religion, and languages, and exhibited a abominable tendency of feudalism to enslave other humans and even nations by spreading the tentacles of colonialism. Another highly disturbing anomalous evolution of mankind is discernible in the dominance of men. Since the inception of Nobel Peace Prize in the year 1901, only 17 women, including Nadia Murad, could surge ahead and get bestowed with the said prize. There are about 206 nations, and even today, not more than 5% women are heads of government. When will the world wake up, or will it wake up ever or not? There's a little in the history of mankind which may enthuse us to inculcate this hope in us. However, it is satisfying to know that the intrinsic nature of man is to hope, and still hope when there is no hope. So on the base of this intrinsic nature of humankind, I, Supriya Bani, an international peace activist, writer, have been humbly credited with authoring of a book, Battling Injustice. This is the cover act, I mean. Published by HarperCollins, and I'm standing here in this prestigious university to make an address on these illustrious women Nobel Peace Prize winners in the fond hope that you all will share my vision of a day when there would be no consciousness of one's being a man or a woman, and both will blend each other in the same way as dewdrops mingle with each other, are specks of different colorful flowers mingle with each other to form honey. Both should flower and flourish in equal measure and paving the way for perfect world peace with equity and justice. I'm much humbled and mallowed by the gesture of this university to invite me to deliver a lecture on my book. In this book, I have scripted the magnificent sagas of 16 women Nobel Peace Prize winners, and I've shown as to how these women from modest beginnings could imbibe unbound love and empathy for their fellow human beings, revealing the subtle softness of their hearts, and at the same time exhibiting their uncanny valor, fortitude, and stealing and waging a relentless crusade against injustice wherever they found injustice. Well, they hailed from different nationalities, you know, as I said, but that one Suttner and Alva Madril, both were from Sweden and who were pacifist. Jane Addams, Emily Green Belch, and Jody Williams from America. Betty Williams and Mary McGuire, both from Ireland. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Laima Baboy, both from Liberia, who fought for the restoration of civil liberties and democracy in Liberia. Aung San Suu Kyi from Myanmar, who valiantly fought against the military junta for the restoration of democracy. Rigoberta Menchú Tum from Guatemala, who strove hard for securing rights of indigenous people. And then three Muslim women Nobel laureates. One is Tawakkul Karman, Shirin Ebadi from Iran, who fought against the suppression of civil liberties under an Islamic state. Tawakkul Karman from Yemen, asserting her status as that being of universal citizen. And Malala Yousafzai, fighting for the right of education for the girl child in Orthodox Muslim Society of Swat Valley in Pakistan. And the stellar pole of humanity, Mother Teresa, who touched the leper and applied the balm of love, taking his body as the body of Christ. They all shed their sweat and blood in securing a world of abiding peace where there's no fear, no hunger, no exploitation, no discrimination, and did all they could for securing everything for all this in need of succor or solace, and above all, by sending a message across the globe of inherent oneness of humanity and thereby knitting the whole world into one family. I'll be briefly discussing some of the inspirational stories from these laureates, but this book is not about, you know, a typical biographies, you know, that one, you know, when that person was born and what happened and dates and stuff. Well, I have written about the dates, but my intention was to actually write about the inspirational stories, you know, why from, you know, what really happened and what are the inspiring stories and how I can bring to the world and what all these ladies have actually suffered in their life. So that's more important. I'll be starting with this lady. Her name is Rigoberta Menchutum. She's from Guatemala and she's a champion of the indigenous people. And her life story is really, really remarkable. Rigoberta's Menchutum mother, okay, was repeatedly raped by army officers, and when she fainted from brutality, she was injected with a serum to revive her back to consciousness, and again raped and disfigured, which left her totally deformed with several cuts on her body and reached a loathsome stage. Her body was then invested with worms. She succumbed to the torture. After she died, soldiers urinated into her mouth, and her body was abandoned to be eaten by vultures and stray dogs. It was a matter of great solace to Rigoberta that her mother finally died and could not be tortured any further. I find it difficult to even compose myself when my thoughts drift towards Rigoberta. I often wonder how she could reconcile herself to her fate, how she could witness so stoically the lynching and the burning of her brother as well. Her father was burned in the Spanish embassy. How she could stomach her mother's suffering at the hands of the army. And despite all his atrocities, she still said, "With the help of our ancestors, we must prevail over the times we are living in." So kudos to her. Such ghastly tragedies in one's life should have driven one to insanity. But there was a tigress who braved such personal calamities so valiantly. She had stopped to work as maid only with a view to learning Spanish and suffer ineffable ignominies. You know, I mean, like some people try to be a little, you know, I mean, the normal people who are just, you know, who are maids or try to help us. But she worked as a maid, so you can imagine. She worked as a maid at somebody's house, and she fled from Guatemala to Mexico, worked as a maid because her whole family was kind of butchered, so that she can learn Spanish and she can communicate with the world. So that curiosity to learn a language, to actually survival, basically not a survival skills, but a passion for helping the world, and then, you know, rising to the level and catapulting herself to the level of winning the Nobel Prize, speaks volume about her. The next is Lema Baboy. She's from Liberia. This is me while during my interview. I mean, some of the pictures, you know, I could use because I was having some and some of the other. But, well, she's from Liberia. And Liberian peace activist credited with having a women's non-violent peace movement. She got the prize in 2011. Women of Liberian mass action for peace that helped bring an end to the second civil war in 2003. So she had been so deficient in fortune that even after being deserted by her husband in an abusive relationship, she gave birth to a child in a hospital. She was turned out by the hospital authorities for failing to pay the charges. She sat on the corridor of the hospital with a newborn baby, and the only warmth she could afford to give the baby was her bare skin. The passerby took her as a beggar, and even threw some loaves of bread and some money before her. This woman rose like a phoenix and was conferred the Nobel Prize for the emancipation of her people from civil war in Liberia. Which made her rise like a phoenix was that it is that she felt that she simply could not allow herself to be wanting when she would be later asked by her children, "Mama, what was your role during the crisis?" So that was one question which was just there in her head, that if I don't do anything in my country against the tyrant Charles Taylor, who was actually ruling the country during her time, what will my children think of me? So this was the main question which was popping her, popping in her mind. And that's the reason that, you know, she worked for it. She also started a very strange kind of strike, you know. She started sex strike. So what was this? That she kind of, you know, used to sing songs about peace and, you know, along with Muslims and Christians and all kind of, you know, like people. And they started a very different trend known as sex strike. So the girls and the women, they refused to have sex with their partners and said that we cannot have sex with you because, you know, we are, I mean, just to actually in some way turn it to a strike. That if you're not willing to work for peace, for our country, then this is what it is. Okay. Well, this is Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. She is also from Liberia, the same country where Lena the boy is. And I want you to, I'm just going to share two stories with you, you know. I mean, there is scene one and scene two, so you can imagine about the two scenes. Scene one is that the small girl, you know, my girl child is born, is just crying, and a person came up, you know, sort of prophet. And he said to her mother that this child will be great. So her mother was definitely very, very happy, you know, thinking about the prophecy that, okay, my daughter is going to be a great person. And there's another scene too about a woman that she's barely in her teens and she's in an abusive relationship. And she's having sons, and you know, so obviously the two kind of stories cannot be about one person, you know. So people would think that it's just about two different person, but this is the story about her, you know. And that's how, from all these different personalities, you know, I mean from, you know, from all such kind of difficulties, she got the Nobel Prize. And she was a former president of Liberia and one of the three proud recipients of the Nobel Prize in 2011. So she got the prize along with Leah Mbeboi, the lady I just mentioned. And this woman, as I told, suffered no lesser. She had to work as a servant in a hotel, mopping its floor to eke out a living for herself, as her husband did not care for her. She had fallen on such horrible days that once she was put in a cell, and at the end of the night, a young tribal, naked girl, was pushed into her cell, whom Sirleaf immediately covered with whatever clothes she could spare from her body to cover a young girl's nakedness. So she was extremely successful as a president, but, you know, I mean, all these personalities, all these difficult, time in her life helped her to move on, to catapult herself to great heights. And that's why she got the Nobel Prize and even served as a two-time president. Another is definitely the darling of the world. It is Malala Yousafzai. Now, everyone knows about the story of Malala Yousafzai, right? I don't have to really mention about it. And she's from a neighboring country. I'm from India. She's from Pakistan. So we have love for each other. And, well, nobody knows about, I mean, a lot of, you know, even after being shot, the one question which was there in our mind was that the only, Malala Yousafzai said that her only regret about the mortal attack upon her was that she could not talk to her attackers before they shot her. She said she wished she could have informed them that whatever she had been doing was in accordance with Islam. As Islams give equal rights of education to men and women, and that she would have been implored them to renounce the path of violence and they had been following, if girls do not go to school and if they're not allowed to go to schools, then how they will get lady doctors. So this is what, you know, the question which Malala wanted to ask her attackers. I actually met them in UK, and this is her father, her mother, and that is me, and that's Malala. Her father is actually a demo of a person, and if every girl, especially in Asian countries, in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, if they have fathers like Zaldin Yousafzai, I think girls will get the wings back to do whatever they want to do, because an incredible portion, and he supports girls a lot. Now, another interesting laureate is Tawakkul Kamal, incredibly interesting laureate is, but So Tawakkul Kamal, as I just mentioned, she's from Yemen. You know, we like, everybody knows about Yemen and Syria, right? The present situation in Yemen is just miserable. So Tawakkul Kamal is a Yemenist journalist, human rights activist, politician, and a senior member of Al-Shab political party, and was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in the year 2011. So this lady, president of Liberia, as I just mentioned, and Lema Baboy, so they all got prize in 2011. So that was a watershed moment, because three women, you know, got the, you know, the prize in one year, sharing this honor with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Lema Baboy. She's the second Muslim to get the Nobel Peace Prize after Shireen Ebadi of Iran. Shireen Ebadi, I'll be talking about her later on, but she was the second one. And she got the prize when she was just 32, so you can imagine. You know, by like 32, people don't even know what to do in life, and they're just so confused. And okay, she was done with the prize. So Tawakkul Kamal became the youngest woman recipient of Nobel Peace Prize, and Malala Yousafzai has since earned this distinction, receiving the award at the tender age of 17 in 2014. So before Malala, she was the youngest, and now Malala is the youngest. The two of most youthful Nobel Peace Prize winners have another feature in common, an adamant fairness that has been both brave and mortal threats. Seemingly oblivious of their personal welfare, indeed the Norwegian Nobel Committee noted that Tawakkul is a courageous lady who has never heeded threats to her own safety, in a defiance of her will and putting herself in harm's way for freedom, and in a protest against tyranny. Tawakkul has doubtless personified courage. Tawakkul has also stayed true to her faith and maintained her cultural identity. Her colorful hijab has become something of a trademark, yet she seems to take the whole world in a warmly clasp. So we all know about the recent case of Jamal Khashoggi. I mean, you know, the Saudi Arabian journalist who was butchered there in Istanbul. So this lady was protesting in front of the embassy because Jamal Khashoggi was her friend. And every time there's a problem there in Arab, you know, be it Syria, be it Yemen, or anywhere, she is very daring and she's very blunt. So she often got many, you know, I mean, death threats because she's a woman. And she belongs to a country where male are fed more than women, and for girls, it is, I mean, it's just a liability. But you can't walk alone in all those countries, and she was alone, and she used to do marches, and she was influenced by Mahatma Gandhi and like many other international, you know, figures. And still, even now, you know, taking the stand for Khashoggi, and she's extremely active, speaks volume about this personality as well. Her name is Wangari Maathai. She's from Kenya, and she was born in Nyeri, a rural area of Kenya, in 1940. She was a founder of the Green Belt Revolution and received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. Well, she and her organization, the Green Belt Revolution, planted almost about 51 million trees. Now, it was way back this, you know, I mean, this current problem of climate change now, you know, like suddenly people are talking about climate change, but she started way early. So she was kind of a trailblazer of her. And she was opposed by a lot of people, you know. She was opposed by her husband and even the president of Kenya, you know, I mean, the former president of Kenya, Daniel Arap Moi, labeled her publicly as a mad woman. So that was, you know, and still she did not care for it, you know. I mean, like, people these days get, you know, I mean, worried about, I mean, small things, if you know, if your friends are not talking to you, or if they're trying to, you know, do some shady things behind your back. But her, she was nationally, you know, embarrassed by, if your own country's president say, okay, she's a mad woman planting some trees, who cares? But she didn't care for all such kind of remarks, and she was still adamant to work for peace. And that is why I would say, but Wangari withstood all such vicissitude and emerged victorious in life in such a magnificent way that she was conferred the Nobel Peace Prize. The another one is Shri Nabadi, a very, very interesting personality. Shri Nabadi was the first Muslim woman, you know, she's from Iran, actually, you know, I just want to give the base. She's from Iran, so an Iranian lawyer, a human rights activist, former judge, and a founding member of Defenders of Human Rights Center in Iran, was a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize for 2003. She was the first Muslim woman to receive the award. Now, she was during the time of Ayatollah Khomeini. I don't know if how many people are aware of Ayatollah Khomeini, but if you've seen the movie Argo, maybe you can have just, you know, I mean, you can go back and just, you know, look. So Ayatollah Khomeini was in power during her time. And she, you know, which during Shireen's, which marked actually a draconian era, particularly for women, as 17th century Islam was sought to be implemented in Iran. Shireen personally experienced the Khomeini's bizarre regime of terror. Now, what they had was Khomeini's. The Khomeini's is kind of morality police, okay? They just go and check on people if you're wearing hijab, if your nails are painted and stuff like that. And they just arrest people on their own whims and fancies and do the stuff just to, you know, harass people. So she experienced personally the Khomeini's bizarre regime of terror. So I repeat, Khomeini is actually a morality police. If I use this word, Khomeini means morality police. And it's thuggery towards normal and even pious Iranian women. In the spring of 1989, she had traveled to Ramsar, a small town near the Caspian Sea, to celebrate Persian New Year. While walking near the town square, a Khomeini officer spotted her and beckoned her to board a minibus parked there. Shireen's protest notwithstanding, the police officer pulled her by her arm and roughly pushed her into the minibus. There she found three women huddled inside, all arrested for innocently violating the Islamic dress code. Shireen's fault was that she was found wearing a baggy pant, a long coat, and a headscarf, which, as per the whims of the morality police, somehow breached the code. One of the women arrested and put in the minibus was a retired school teacher who had reportedly sinned for having worn slippers due to her swollen feet. She only had the stern attitude of Khomeini's officer when she protested that nowhere in the Quran it is stated that wearing slippers is a crime for women. There were innumerable instances of morality police harassing women. Their special focus as well, all these Iranian women, whether Muslims, Christians, or Jews. Things have come to such a sorry state of affairs that even if a dating couple wanted to go out, they would take a small cousin or some young male relative. This disguise, they might pass for, you know, for a family and be ignored by a morality police for defying the ban on girls moving with an unrelated man. She fought every gun for the restoration of civil rights and against the atrocities of the police. One of the Shireen's closest friends, Raya, suffered comic injustice in an event fairly typical of those times, for what she would consider harmless and innocent behavior. So she had a friend known as Soraya. I'm going to explain the story of Soraya because I think it's very important to understand the kind of mentality they were having and they still have in like certain parts in the Middle East. And of course, certain section of the society. Soraya was detained and endured an ordeal for which she had no means of redress. She, her fiancé, and his two friends ran afoul of the Comet after they went together to her home to visit her mother. The morality police arrested them all, took Soraya away, and interrogated her male companions separately. They were suspected of being members of the Mujahideen Khalq organization, an opponent of Ayatollah Khomeini's Islamic Revolution. Once the arresting officer learned that Soraya and her fiancé and other male companions were not a threat to the government, they were still not released. They were charged for traveling together while being unrelated and unmarried. The officer tried to persuade Soraya to confess that she had been engaged in sexual relations with all the men. The judge was so kind, you know, you can see. The judge even offered to take Soraya as his temporary wife. I mean, I'm just saying it sarcastically. If she confessed her guilt, so judge even offered to take Soraya as his temporary wife if she confessed her guilt. Soraya shouted at the officer that she had no physical contact with any of her male companions, including her fiancé. Notwithstanding the trivialty of the purported offense, the judge pronounced his judgment against Soraya, finding her guilty of violation of the Islamic law for moving together in public with unrelated men, and ordered that she would be summarily given 40 lashes. Before any officer could raise his hand to carry out the punishment, she admonished the judge for not knowing the Shariat fully, according to which a woman can be given corporal punishment only by another woman. The judge felt grossly humiliated because he could not counter Soraya's argument, and picked by her highlighting his mistake, pronounced instead a sentence of 80 lashes on her fiancé. A fiancé was promptly forced to lie on the floor, and 80 lashes were delivered without the flagellator keeping the Holy Quran under his arm so the blows would be softened. As the Quran prescribes, it's actually, you know, it's just a part of the book, and this is what I got to know from the stories. And Soraya's fiancé wounds from the flogging were so severe that the blood began oozing from them, provoking Soraya's hysterical condemnation of judge. Soraya's case is illustrative of the grotesque and arbitrary cruelty that commit regularly inflicted upon the innocent people, especially women, for any liberty they took with regard to their personal conduct. Young women routinely drew the comet's ire and summary retribution for such venial offenses as wearing lipstick. The Iranian people commonly believe the morality police officer harassed people simply because they had nothing else to do. So this was the story of Shireen Ebadi, and when she got the Nobel Prize, she received so many death threats. And if you have seen the movie Argo, so you will see that, you know, I mean, the American diplomats were actually kept as hostages during the Ayatollah Khomeini time, and Jimmy Carter was a president during that time. So Shireen was there, and when she got the prize in 2003, she could not live in Iran anymore, and she fled to UK. So UK gave asylum. UK is, you know, so UK gave asylum to Malala Yousafzai, and of course Shireen Abadi. And now it's another Nobel laureate. Well, Jane Addams, she's an American Nobel Peace Prize. The world knows about her. Well, she's much known as a woman to have voiced Shikhar State, opposing one's own country and braving public condemnation. She was part of the vanguard of peace activists who successfully championed to stop the U.S. from entering World War I. Fortunately for Jane, her voice was heard and appreciated in her lifetime, as she became the second woman and the first American to receive the Nobel Peace Prize in 1931. Jane is widely acknowledged as the first woman philosopher in the history of the United States. Jane is also famous for having founded the social settlement movement in Chicago. She founded Hull House in Chicago in 1905, and it was the first settlement house in the United States. President Barack Obama, in his letter to my daughters, called upon them to seek inspiration from this wonderful lady. Now, there's a very controversial figure, but still, you know, like, people have different opinions. It's Aung San Suu Kyi, and I don't know how many people know about her. She's from Myanmar. She got the Nobel Peace Prize for restoring democracy in Burma, and I met her and I interviewed her, and I was fortunate enough that she gave me time for this book. And Aung San Suu Kyi has proved her mettle, actually, perseverance and fortitude against the ruthless military junta, and stood by her people despite grave mortal threats. Each day, as she remained in the captivity of military junta for 18 years out of 20 when she was set free. One can scarcely imagine the suffering Aung San Suu Kyi had to endure in her life. Unlike other prisoners of conscience in the 20th century, such as Nelson Mandela, however, she voluntarily accepted her fate. She could go to UK anytime. Her husband was in Oxford. Her whole family was in Oxford. She married a Tibetan guy, and she fell in love with a Tibetan guy there in Oxford. She's the daughter of Aung San, who was kind of the farm, Aung San is a father name. So Aung San was the kind of the, you know, the founding father of Burma. Like, we have Mahatma Gandhi there in India, you know, the father of a nation. So similarly, the father of nation for Myanmar, also known as Burma, was Aung San. So she's Aung San's daughter, Aung San Suu Kyi. So she had a choice to go back anytime, you know. I mean, she was in house arrest for so many years, but she, when asked by the military junta that you can go to Oxford, have a nice time, you don't have to stay here and, you know, be in house arrest, because there were a lot of international pressure on the military junta to release Aung San Suu Kyi from the house arrest, but she did not do it. She did not do it because of the sole reason that she said she needs to talk about democracy. Her husband died due to cancer, and the last call which she did in the British embassy, I mean, when she received a call from Michael, her husband, and she was just speaking to Michael, and something went wrong in the phone, and he was about to tell her that he's suffering from cancer, but she could not even go. And the phone just, you know, I mean, cut, and then she was just, you know, hello, 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 Michael, but no, you know, I mean, they couldn't even talk. So that was her, you know, destiny. Despite being in love, despite having a good marriage and like two sons, she could not even talk to them or even meet them and, you know, pay the last rites, because she was, you know, she chose her people. And at any time in her incarceration, she could have thrown in the towel and submitted herself to the comfortable ignominy of exile back to the UK and her family, as just mentioned. She did not do and willingly accepted her imprisonment, forced estrangement from her family, and other privations demonstrate her commitment to her people, as it would not her courage. When I visited Myanmar and met her in our office, where with diplomatic, for nature, she took my right hand in both her hands and pressed them so affectionately that I can still feel the, that I can still feel the warmth. So when I met her, I was just thinking, okay, she's a big name, maybe, her office would be like a 5-star or something, great tables, and, a beautiful place. I mean, usually presidents do have, but it was just 2 chairs and one small refrigerator, and that was it. And she is presently, leading the National League of Democracy there in Burma. And I would also like to talk a bit about Rohingya crisis. I don't know if you know about Rohingya. So there is a lot of, a crisis happening between the Buddhist monks and the Rohingya crisis. So I just want her to be more vocal about all kind of exploitations, because this is what we expect from a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And this is actually Wirtha Wons Sutner, and she is the first woman to get Nobel Peace Prize. So this is how this whole started. I'm really not talking about all the laureates, but I've just picked a few to talk about. And Wirtha Wons Sutner is the first woman to get Nobel Peace Prize, and she was from Czech-Australian pacifist journalist and novelist. Wirtha was born on 9th June 1843 in Prague, and she boasted a proud military heritage and exaggerated nationalism and advanced armament. She stepped into the limelight of peace movement in 1889 with her pacifist novel, Diva Vinayadur, Lay Down Your Arms. The title was provocative and offensive for those who cherished military traditions. Wirtha Wons Sutner served as secretary to Alfred Nobel and was greatly instrumental in Alfred Nobel's decision to institute the Nobel Prize. So the guy who was all about dynamite, Alfred Nobel, was supposedly in love with Wirtha Sutner, but she was married to somebody else. But still, it was her influence on Alfred Nobel's mind that kind of changed his mind. And from dynamite, he started, the biggest prize in the world, which is the Nobel Peace Prize. So in the entire book, I feel the central message of each of these 16 female Nobel Peace laureates is never submit to evil. Instead, subdue evil with grit and determination. Grasping and conveying the courage of these women has been the core of my entire effort. I have not penned a brief biographies of these eminent laureates and included all relevant events from their life that show the purity of their mind. And I try to express the depth of human empathy in which I have found an abundance in them. Truly, each of them is an enigma in herself and has left a great mark on my personal psyche. By taking a closer look at these incredible stories in 16 women Nobel laureates, it is my hope that more people will be catapulted to a new height of self-awareness and will start interacting with the world with a sense of urgency that leads to others for others' sake. Doing so, we can eventually create feelings of elation and goodwill that truly elevates us. Well, I was kind enough, when this book when I was writing the book and the book was kind of ready, so these laureates were also very kind to edit the chapters with me, which is very, very rare. So they sat with me, including Malala, they sat with me, and because they also wanted me, that a book should come out which is about all the laureates, because people only know one laureate or two laureate, but they don't know what all problems faced with other, say for example, Liberian Nobel laureate. And there are so many heroes who have actually helped them, like Abigail Disney. I think she's a niece of, no, not think, I'm sure that she's a niece of Walt Disney. And she kind of helped Leah Mabavoy, and Leah Mabavoy lived in New York. I mean, the second Nobel Peace Prize winner I talked about, and helped her, and, you know, and Angelina Jolie helped Malala Yousafzai. And then the recent one is Nadia Murad. I don't have her picture, but you can Google it. She is the client of Amal Clooney, that's George Clooney's wife. And they are, they are making a case against ISIS in the International Criminal Court, and they are actually, working for it. And she happens to be a Yazidi girl. So what ISIS is actually doing is they're keeping girls for sex slave, and they don't care that you're Muslim or non-Muslim. For them, you just need to be a girl, and that's it. And that is against the sexual slavery, and that's why she got the Nobel Peace Prize this year. And I shared with some people, and I'm just sharing some of the responses. I'm not sharing the entire because that will take very long. Robert Kennedy's daughter did like her. Did like this book because she says, speak truth to power, and that's why she tweeted about it. I met her twice, once at the Prime Minister of India's office and Colombian President's office. I just recently came from Iceland, and that's the Prime Minister of Iceland. So she is also a very vocal advocate about climate change and gender equality. So now I'm working on my second project, which is actually about the women politicians, and they are all working for the equal pay for like equal work. So because they also want that the gender problem should be solved, and that's why it is. And I also happen to share with, you know, the former president of East Timor. This person has also got the Nobel Peace Prize. So wherever I've traveled all across the world, and I was fortunate enough, but I really worked hard to get their support, because that was not easy coming from a place, you know, from the Northern India. This is the former president of India, but when I met him, he was the current president. So that was last year, actually. This is the vice president. He's the current president. I did share the book, and he was happy to see the endorsements and everything, that this book should go to every school, and the Indian parliament is actually having it, and we're trying to push in the European parliament as well, so that they can really be vocal about peace, because it's not a book per se, it's actually raising a sword. Really a pen, because with a pen you can change the world, not by a sword, but definitely a pen. And he's the president of Colombia. He got the Nobel Prize in 2016. Now he's actually the ex-president. But he was also very, very, very kind enough to actually support the book. And because he himself got the Nobel Prize, and he said that I am not a dreamer. I'm not the only one. I mean, the John Lennon words. Correct me if I'm wrong. So anyways, yeah. So this is the Indian Nobel Peace Prize winner, Kailash Satyarthi. And the one who graced my book with his foreword, along with Dalai Lama's blog, which is inside the book. And this is Microsoft, this is the website, and they're selling with Jimmy Carter's new book. And I'm very, very humbled to be at one of the top 10 books on peace in the world. And this is Jody Williams, the person who banned the lady, the landmines. And this is the last one, Aung San Suu Kyi, the lady with the peacock. So the peacock is actually the symbol of NLD, that's the ruling party there in Burma. And these are some of the laureates of the tweeted together. This is the Noble Women Initiative. This is Rigoberta Tavakkulkarman, Jodi, and Shireen. I was telling about Ayatollah, the Iran lady, and Merritt Maguire, and Leah Mabavoy. And yes, so that's it. Thank you. Yeah.
I apologize, I came in a little late, and maybe you talked about it, but what took you on this journey to do the stories?
I was in fifth grade, and I often used to think about Martin Luther King Jr. I was kind of obsessed with him, and I am still. And a story, I had a dream, and all these poems were just, they were in my mental album. So what happened that I was reading a newspaper, and I read about Aung San Suu Kyi during that time, because she was in news, because she was in house arrest and I was in school. So I was aware of Nelson Mandela, but I wasn't aware of Aung San Suu Kyi during that time and what it takes to be in house arrest. So my curiosity as a child was that okay, you know, like girls do get bullied in school or in college, you know, and what happens when they face isolation? Or, you know, it's just a teenage thing which I was having that, you know, the things are not well, school is not happening, what to do? So I thought maybe I will try to look for some kind of role models, and, you know, there were definitely none in my class. So I thought to look worldwide to actually kind of to satisfy myself that I am doing better than many, many people, so I don't have to really bother about the bullying and stuff like that. So when I thought about Aung San Suu Kyi, I wanted to know what it takes to be in isolation for 18 years for some cause which is, you know, which you do not even know, I mean, what's gonna come out. So, and with that idea, I went to Burma, and I was very extremely fortunate to get in time, because I interviewed her when she was just released from the house arrest. So that was the most difficult thing, because I couldn't even go. Yeah, I just went in a disguise as a tourist, because you can't just go and say, I'm here to interview Aung San Suu Kyi, they're gonna shoot you for that. So you just go to, so I went, I was in college, and I went to that place as a tourist saying that I'm here to visit some Buddhist temple, which was also right. And, but I did inform Aung San Suu Kyi that I will be coming there. So meeting her during that time, I wanted to know, okay, I have interviewed one, I have known one, what about others? So that's how it all started, from one to second and so on. Yeah, thank you. Yeah?
Hello.
Hi.
Do you think that in all these years of yearning, of doing and researching the book, you found that in history, woman has been shallowed or isolated compared with men in the place they take in the history of, in the world's history?
Of course. You know, women were, I mean, women were never even, you know, I mean, in certain areas, in certain countries, they were not even considered as human beings, actually telling you. And if you can say, you know, we all talk about gender equality, I need to do this, and I'm a champion of human rights and stuff like that. It looks fancy, you know, and it looks okay on paper. But when the time to implement it, you know, like, I mean, like, people just run away. So even in the Nobel Peace Prize, I mean, 16 women, I mean, it is actually a very small number.
Mm-hmm.
And so 16 women got just 16 and hundreds of men, you know. So, I mean, you see the ratio here, and you talk about the president, the important presidents, Merkel, Theresa May, I'm just naming, it's not okay, I'm not endorsing any like kind of politician, just naming. Or maybe Jacinda Ardern from like New Zealand. So are there hardly five or six who are actually the current presidents? Maybe Lithuania president or, but so, I mean, they are nowhere. So, and it was always there like this. Things have actually improved now, and they should improve more. But we are actually doing a lot better than like 50 years ago. And especially when like Shireen Abadi is around, she said that, if you are a woman, forget it. Your life is not even enough worth of a testicle of a man, and that was her life. I mean, that was her wording. So yeah, it was always there.
Do you think there's a country that in the world that puts women in a place where they really feel equal, or maybe not a country but a culture where?
Well, we have a country now, and that's definitely Iceland, and they have just came up with a bill, and that equal pay for equal work, and they are very, very, very strict about it. So they are really, I mean, that and according to the World Economic Forum, Iceland has stopped over the past 8 years when it comes to gender equality. So if you see the whole world, Iceland tops the list. So I think we all need to learn from that small country the way, you know, they are really implementing. And they have the female president, like Katrin Jakobsdottir, they're working for climate change and so many other things. So there is a country. But as for if you say culture, I don't know, because I'm coming from a rigid patriarchal society in India also, even in Pakistan and somewhere even in here in the US, because we never had a woman president as for now. But that doesn't make, like, if you don't have a woman president, that doesn't mean that you're not liberal, something like that. It depends on the voting, and of course, but at least give us the opportunity to run for it, you know, so that is important. So I would say yes, Iceland.
What about historically, there are countries or groups in the world that have placed women in esteem?
Well,
current times.
Yeah, well, one thing about India, I mean, like, because I only know 10 to 12 countries and their culture, and not really worldwide, I mean, wherever countries have traveled, but if you talk about history, well, one thing in India is that they treat women as goddess, because we have a lot of female, you know, goddess here in Hindus, so we have about 10,000 goddess and stuff, so we always, but, I mean, you know, it's just a form the way they pray it, but they take women as goddess, but now, you know, the current Indian woman says that do not teach us as goddess, just treat us equal because we want equality. So they keep them as pedestrian, and we have Durga Puja, okay? This is a kind of a worship. So what they do is that they worship female goddess. But that is one thing, and the other thing, a girl is being raped. And, you know, so, you know, that is actually paradoxical. So people don't think, and when they just worship a female god, they don't think that they need to help the woman, you know, as well, because that goes hand in hand. So yeah, because it is actually, you know, I'm coming from a very patriarchal society where we have used to Mughals and like one king having 12 wives, that's okay, but I mean, like, one woman having 12 husbands, not possible. So that way. Exactly.
So what is the psychology behind that?
Exactly.
All these Nobel laureate women struggled with.
You're absolutely right.
And then also they have mothers who raise them. So somehow it gets, you know, the boys don't get the respect for their mothers even inculcated as part of the culture.
Well, one thing I can tell you is that it differs from country to country, but yes, the basic mentality is kind of same, because one thing is that, for example, in certain areas here in Middle East, as I just mentioned, that the boys are fed more than girls. So if you're a girl, they don't care. So if a child is seeing this, a male child is seeing this from a very tender age, that okay, that my sister isn't worth it, you know, okay, she, you know, she's just eating the leftovers and I'm having the, you know, full-time meal. So with time, he loses respect for his mother because he sees his father doing all such kind of atrocities on his mother. And this builds up the kind of mentality they have. And some turn out to be butchers, some turn out to be, you know, complete tyrant people. So I think it all depends on how your family nourish it and what are your family values. But even if you have a good family values and you move out from the home, you see, you know, the kind of problems we have. For example, there in Afghanistan, there is an Angelina Jolie's movie, you know, The Breadwinner. I don't know how many people have seen it, but the small girls who were girls but yet wanted to help their family, you know, at, you know, they used to cut their hairs and look like boy to go out and eat the bread and to do something, because they know that they are boys and they won't be allowed to walk and they'll be just shooed away. So just for the survival. So I think people forget it because they are bond that way, that women are just secondary. We can, you know, if this wife is not okay, we can get another. So they have that mentality, and it's kind of medieval. It is medieval, but yeah, there are people who are still, you know, having this kind of mentality.
So thanks so much. It was wonderful to listen to you and your experience with all these Nobel laureates.
Thank you.
You're from India, and I'm sure, like, by interviewing these wonderful ladies, you have some kind of an idea that what it takes to be one of the winners. you know, Indian women are doing amazing jobs, but you know, in all sorts of fields. But none of the Indian women so far won any Nobel Peace Prize. What would be your opinion as a author of such a wonderful book?
Well, I don't see people for their nationality. So for me, an Indian getting a Nobel Prize or a Pakistani getting a Nobel Prize or an American, it's just fine with me. Because I don't see myself as, I don't relate myself to one particular country, because that's the first thing we need to think if you talk about world peace as global citizens, that this, you know, that Syria is also my country, America is also my country, Ireland is also my country, India is also my country. That's the basic attitude. But as for the Nobel Peace Prize, if you do your work in FT, you know, the Nobel Prize is just, you know, they just meticulously see what you're doing. And it's not about which woman get it. You know, I mean, like Mother Teresa spent a lot of time in India. So I still do not see, I still do not focus on nationalities. What I focus is if they're doing the right thing, and if their work, if millions of people are getting impacted by their life. For example, the recent one is Nadia Murad. So she is kind of, you know, somebody who's talking about ISIS, and her life is actually impact. Her story can actually move a lot of people, because she's talking about sexual slavery. So that is impacting it a life, you know, at a very big level. So
that leads to my second question.
Mm-hmm.
So think about like Malala or
okay.
the lady from Myanmar, Burma.
Yeah,
so what Malala is doing, like she fight for education, right to education for
yeah.
girl child.
Yeah.
The situation in Pakistan is still not seismic change.
I know. Mm-hmm.
And you are talking about democracy and Rohingya Muslim. You said that you will talk about that, so maybe I'm instigating you to talk about the Rohingya
yeah, of
situation
course.
Right now. So when they win, what are their, like what, I mean, you would know more that what are they doing and how they plan to bring the change more.
Even after, actually, you know, even after getting the Nobel Peace Prize, your journey becomes much more difficult because the world is watching you.
Yeah.
You know, but that is just a normal statement. That doesn't mean anything. What I'm trying to focus is that they are doing it and they're still doing it. And if you really want to talk about the Rohingya crisis, actually there are two different school of thoughts, okay? And I'm not promoting any school of thought. I'm just stating the facts. One fact is that the Rohingyas were killing Buddhists, and they were tapping their head and drinking skull from their, drinking blood from their skulls. And they were doing it for a very long time. That's one school of thought, okay? And then after 10 years or something, the monks got very tired of it, and that's when, you know, they also started retaliating and killing the people. So that was one part. Then the other school of thought says that, no, there was no persecution, only Rohingya were being tortured, but there is evidence of Buddhist monks and Buddhist girls being raped, and that is a fact. So Aung San Suu Kyi's recent interviews, she said there's a crime on both sides. The world is only talking about Rohingya. Why they're not talking about the Buddhist man? She's not saying that. I have no idea about why. I mean, I think personally she should be more vocal about things. She should be more, vocal about things. But we don't know what's actually happening there in Burma. But the bottom line is that wherever there is a violation of human rights, people should be vocal about it. Because sometimes people get involved in the politics and they see the vote banks and stuff like that, and that keeps them mum. But that's not the right way to, you know, do things. Even if the chair goes from your hand, I mean, you being the president, let it go. But what is important is that the people are at least being saved. So there are different schools of thought. One person saying, I mean, the people who support Buddhists are saying that, and the people who support Muslims are saying the different state. But the bottom line is, whosoever is getting, victimized, we should go and help them. So that's the bottom line, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have this last question. I think that it is important to highlight and to publish those kind of books about women, because it is the way to know that a woman has a role in the society.
Mm-hmm.
But after writing that book, how do you see the future about women? Because now there is a world slogan that it says the future is female, no? And after writing it, how do you see the future? And after after that, do you think that there is a difference between from the role of the woman between the East world and the West world? Because I am from Latin America, and I can see that I have a little bit bias in terms of my freedoms comparing a woman from the other side of the world.
No, but I mean, what is the question? I didn't understand.
After seeing, my first question is, how do you see the future about women? No, and if this future is the same for the from the East part of the world and the West part of the world? Because as a Latin America, I see that there is a difference between the freedom of the woman from the.
I got it. Since you are from Latin America, so you know about the lady, I don't remember her name exactly, but I've met her in Hague. I cannot really remember her name right now. She's from Venezuela and her husband is imprisoned. And she's really popular. She was in there with the White House to actually release. A Lope something, I don't know. It's extremely popular. I'm sorry, I can't really remember her name right now, but she is from Venezuela and her husband is in prison. And, you know, she did meet President Barack Obama and she, even like Trump is trying to work for it. And but, you know, he is still in the jail. So if I see that she's also not a normal person. So I see the future of women only if women are themselves willing to do something for it, because you need to create a space for them. So, I mean, there is a kind of a... thing which just comes in my mind, and that's from Margaret Thatcher. She once stated that, that whenever I used to enter the parliament, I used to see just black boots and just one heel. You know what I mean? The thousands and thousands of male boots and just one heel. So what it takes to get that one heel in a room full of male is your audacity, what you're willing to do, because no one is going to do something for you and not going to give you a plate. What matters is what you are willing to do for yourself and for humanity. So I think it all depends from person to person, from like woman to woman. And if we women, you know, I mean, join hands in hand and do something about it, the world can change. Yeah, so that's the first answer. So your second...
The difference between the woman from the west side of the world and the east side of the world, in terms of freedom.
It is. I mean, this is so obvious. The world knows about, you know. I mean, there is a lot of difference. You know, there is a patriarchy in West also. There is a patriarchal, culture in West also. But the ratio varies, you know. For example, in Pakistan, it is different. If in Afghanistan, it is different. In Colombia, it is different. You are free in Colombia, but you are not that free in certain areas, in like Kabul or they're in Afghanistan. I mean, they're in Afghanistan, in certain parts in Pakistan, and even some parts, they're in Bangladesh as well. So it depends. It completely depends. But on a whole, you don't have to worry about, you know, all these stereotypes. And if you are a taboo breaker, and that for good, you don't have to worry about it, because they will chase you once you are at some kind of a destination and working for it, and all these people will just change their opinion about you. Because this is what exactly happened with Tawakkul Karman, the lady who was wearing hijab. So she was from Yemen, and everybody used to say, okay, so you're not allowed to go out alone and stuff like that, and how dare you march for like democracy. But she didn't care. And now all those people are actually, oh God, she got a Nobel Prize. Now what to do? Now she's way out of her league. So that's what happens, you know, when you work together. Yeah. Okay.
Well, can we give Sophie a round of applause?
Thank you.